This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A Central Illinois business leader is mourning the lost opportunity in President Trump's reversal on Cuba policy.
They import 80% of their chicken from Mexico. So, you know, the amount of chicken that we can produce in the United States makes it an elementary market for us to work with.
Former State Treasurer Dan Rutherford talks with GLT's Colleen Reynolds about his Cuba experience and the Trump trade policy. The Illinois Public Radio Politics Roundtable is monitoring progress toward a state budget. Hear the latest. And during an edition of What's on Your Turntable, John Norton stops by Waiting Room Records for some music you might not expect to hear there. That plus a GLT News update on the way. It's June 26th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A year ago, candidate Donald Trump was very big on investing in Cuba, suggesting it would be great to see one or more Trump hotels there. But as president, Trump announced new policies to discourage U.S. travelers from putting money into Cuban government coffers. Former state senator and treasurer Dan Rutherford now owns a travel club that takes groups to Cuba periodically, and he talked with WGLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds about the impact of President Trump's rhetoric and policy shift away from the Obama administration's efforts to normalize relations with the island nation.
Your relationship with Cuba, it dates back a few decades.
Actually, it has been quite some time. My first visit to Cuba was in 1999 with Governor George Ryan, when he went down there on that historic trip to be the first sitting governor in the United States to visit since the revolution of 1959.
And at that time, what was that trip all about?
If one reflects back, we were during the Clinton administration in the White House. So it was a time when many of us, and I happen to be one of these, that believed then and today that it is much better to have engagements with countries on food, medicine, and educational materials for trade, as opposed to just having a complete blockade. And for two reasons. One, it helps the American business, agriculture in particular, and others to sell product. But the other thing is, it also then removes the, the propaganda that Cuba and other countries for embargoes could say, you know, you're helping to starve our children, you're not getting us medicine. So I believed in that, and Governor Ryan did as well, and put together a delegation of business leaders and some elected officials, asked me, because I was in international business in the private sector at the time. And we went there for a three-day visit to engage with the ministries of healthcare and agriculture and ultimately the executive branch to talk about what we can do to help normalize relations between our two countries and eventually sell more Illinois product there.
And did it work?
You know, it did to some extent. And let me break it into two pieces. One piece is a humanitarian, cultural type of exchange, and the other was in actual factual commerce. And, you know, I know our agriculture community, particularly here in the Midwest, was very supportive of it. Some of the larger companies that had capacity at that time to do some international trade eventually did sell some grain to Cuba. I know when the first cargo barge, I think would be the right word for it, the barge went down towards Cuba, that was a big deal. And that came from Illinois, and I think that helped kind of get things moving on some of the agriculture. Didn't turn out over the years to be as big as much as we wanted, because eventually White House has changed and so did policy. The second thing that I would note is on the cultural type of exchange, the young people. And 2 years after 1999, in 2001, in fact, some local luminaries there in the McLean County area, Bob and Julie Dobsky, were the sponsors to help take a group of softball players to Cuba, you know, under their local, at that time, their franchise of McDonald's. And organizers asked me to join them, and I did. I said, I'll pay my own way, of course, but went down. And so here you had these young people from central Illinois playing softball for 2 or 3 or 4 days, boys and girls, with the Cuban boys and girls. So those kind of things and relations, I'm positive, are helpful, because I haven't seen or talked to any of the kids that were with us back then, but, you know, now we're so many years later, and they're young adults. They have to have a better appreciation of what international relations are about, and hopefully to help bring about a better stability in countries between the U.S. and Cuba and others around the world.
Under President Obama, there was a normalizing of relations to an extent, and really it was with a longer view of easing restrictions and opening up trade. And I can recall that Donald Trump just a year ago talked about how he would love to set up some Trump hotels in Cuba, and he seemed very supportive of the Obama administration's direction. But then, now as president, he really changed direction. And I understand you were actually in Cuba when that announcement came out.
Yes, I was. In fact, a step before that, when President Obama announced removing Cuba from the state-sanctioned terrorist list, I was in Cuba then. It happened at the same day, and of course was able to talk with the Cubans, and it's like, you know, terrorism and sponsored, state-sponsored and all of that stuff hasn't been going on for decades in that country. And then, yes, last Friday I was in Havana the day that President Trump announced. But I think, Colleen, in a couple of points, what President Obama did was he couldn't lift the embargo. That was put into place by the United States Congress. So as president, he couldn't lift it. He needed and could only do things by executive order. And he allowed it to be for individuals to travel to Cuba, still under the travel regulations of the U.S. Department of Treasury. But it was a self-declaration that the individuals would make. He also provided for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, U.S. Department of Commerce, and some from the Homeland Security area to engage the Cuban government on what we can do to help normalize and help with regards to trade, but also with regards to pharmaceuticals. And Cuba has been dramatically advanced in areas with regards to lung cancer medicine and diabetes. They've had a phenomenal biotech operation going there. So we started to, under the Obama administration, started to engage, and what can they import, what can, you know, export and so forth. Well, then candidate Trump had talked about Cuba, and obviously from his private enterprises and casinos, hotels and restaurants and so forth. Well, then the time came for the election, and candidate Trump had made it pretty clear when he was in Miami in the little Havana area that, you know, he was going to get hard on the policies of Obama, and that rallied up the Cuban Americans that have, you know, some very displeasurable thoughts towards the regime in Cuba, which I understand. But it came to the election. He didn't carry Miami, but he didn't lose it as much, and many accredit his carrying the Florida Electoral College because of the Cuban American vote. So now we come to June of 2017, and he goes to Cuba with Senator Marco Rubio and others to say, okay, I am going to change the Obama relationship with Cuba. So it was a good rhetorical, political type of comment. In reality, we still have the embassy there. We still have Americans allowed to travel to Cuba, not individuals by themselves. You need to, you know, be a part of a sanctioned group to go down there, and that's what our travel club does, and we were doing it before Obama changes. And then has also stopped some of the commerce that was going on with Cuba. And Colleen, because the administration still has about, you know, 90 days to write the regulations to implement the president's directive, we'll still need to have about 3 months to ferret out exactly the harm or benefit to the whole thing. And if nothing else, what I personally happen to believe is the negative is that it has put a wet towel over the feeling from American agriculture, American business, that we're going to be able to progressively move to better relationship with Cuba in the near future.
You're listening to Sound Ideas, and I'm Colleen Reynolds, talking with former state senator and treasurer and now owner of Global Relations Travel Club, Dan Rutherford. And so now companies that were interested in investing and developing new markets are reacting by by not investing?
Yeah, fair enough. And the two things you said, one is investing and then one is about the market. From the investing standpoint, and in fact, Starwood's Hotels, which was bought out by Marriott, they had received approval from the United States Department of Treasury during the Obama administration for changes in Cuba, and they have made investments into hotels and then to manage Cuban hotels, some Cuban hotels. What's happened, though, since the Trump announcement is that they have, those that they had in place will be grandfathered in, which means that they were already operating under a license that the U.S. Department of Treasury will let them continue. But they cannot then go into a new one, meaning a new license. But what that did, though, is it basically said to Starwood and Marriott, and I'm not tied with them in any way, is they're not looking to, you know, even maybe continue with what they've got because they don't know where this administration is going to go in the future. From the standpoint of the trade, separate from investment, it's become concerning because even our American agriculture, U.S. Department of Agriculture secretary didn't seem to be pleased about the announcement. And obviously, I think that our local county and our local state farm bureau and farm unions associations have not been happy with it because it once again puts that wet, damp blanket over what could be a relatively lucrative trade opportunity with an island that's only 90 miles away. And, you know, put it in perspective, Cuba's small. Cuba's population is about the size of Illinois. But the economy is dramatically small. So it's not a big market, but the point of it is, it's like our neighbor market. The largest trade partner for the United States is Canada. Well, it's because it's right there. And if you have yourself a country such as Cuba, they import 80% of their chicken from Mexico. I mean, you know, in Latin America, chicken is a highly consumed protein. So, you know, the amount of chicken that we can produce in the United States and take it down the St. Lawrence and put it into Cuba makes it an elementary market for us to work with. But our government has precluded us from taking advantage of that.
It's interesting, too, that today you read the polls, and even most Cuban Americans are not in favor of these kinds of sanctions.
You're right. And the statistic on the Cuban American, it's interesting to see the cross tabs on that, in that the older Cuban Americans, that absolutely, it was terrible. You know, what they had to suffer through back in the 1950s and the early 60s and eventually the nationalization of their property. I am totally about making reprimations on all of that. I mean, I understand it. But how you get to that point is you got to move on, but move on to have dialogue. And the younger Cuban Americans are the ones that skew that percentage, saying, let's engage, let's get this going. The American public is behind it as well. So it's definitely a political situation. And here, let me just say this. Part of our ideology is to be able to be independent and do what we want, obviously within the confines of a proper society. There is only one country on this planet that United States citizens, because of their government, is precluded from traveling. Our government does not preclude us from going to Russia. Our government does not preclude us from going to Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, or Pakistan. But our United States government precludes us without a license and without proper process to go to Cuba. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Well, let me ask you, too, don't we have an example of capitalism working to foster democracy as we look at what happened with the Soviet Union?
Ask Mikhail Gorbachev. Absolutely, Colleen. And I'm not a student of it. I mean, I was around and observant, but I'm not an economic student of it. But you look at what happened with the Soviet Union and their lack of economic stimulus and Americans, you know, prodding and pursuing. Well, now it's no longer the Soviet Union. It's broken into the various states. And I think to bring it back to the conversation of Cuba, Colleen, we see it going on now. There's what's called paladars, which means that they are privately run out of people's home. You've got people that own their own 1950s car that are now renting them out for taxis, private, personal, not the government. I've gotten into a 1950s Chevy, and it was driven by a physician, a doctor. She, female, made more money driving her family's old car as a taxi than she did as a physician. You've got examples in Cuba of Casa Particular, which are, in essence, a bed and breakfast. The government of Cuba, not that long ago, actually, allowed people to take a room in their home and make it into a B&B, in part because they didn't have enough capacity for hotels for the Europeans and Canadians coming, but also because it allowed them to make some extra money. So there's an example of capitalism, free market, working in the country of Cuba. And I'm concerned because the restrictions that the president, this president, Trump, has put on will cause less traffic to the private restaurants, the private casas, and to the private taxis than if he'd have left it alone.
So ultimately, you say this policy will likely do more to harm the spread of capitalism, which is to some extent on a small scale operating and helping improve the lives of people in Cuba.
Absolutely. I totally believe it. Now, here, I don't want to have us Americans get too big in our boots. There are, I'll be off by 100,000, but there's 1.3 million Europeans that visit Cuba. They're not precluded from it. There's 1.1 million Canadians that visit Cuba. They're not precluded from it. There's a few hundred thousand because of the expansion opportunity that the President Obama provided to visit Cuba. We are a small percentage, but the difference is we are the growing opportunity, and candidly, so many times from the Cuban people, they prefer the Americans because we're good tippers. You know, they're willing to do things. The Canadians generally go to an all-inclusive resort in Varadero for 10 days or 2 weeks, and they won't even leave. They won't even get into the Cuban environment. They'll sit there at the all-day buffet and the open drinks by the pool, swim, get another drink and eat some more buffet. Where we Americans, we go to Hemingway's home. The Americans will go see Pilar, the boat from Old Man and the Sea. We'll go to the Revolution Museum, even though the history, according to Cuba, is different than ours. You know, we as Americans will go into and dive into and engage the Cuban society and people where the others generally don't.
So where do you see this ultimately heading? Do you think that the power of companies like ADM and Cargill and many, many others will have the kind of influence to maybe make the president rethink this change?
My gut tells me no. And it isn't because they don't have clout. Because, Monsanto's and all of those you mentioned, and deservedly so, they're big. But the Cuban market is, in light of the multi-billion multinationals, is a small market. It's like, how much energy and clout do I need to expend to get to a market of 12 million people? You know, it's like going to Illinois. You know, now that the president has made his proclamation, it's almost impossible to pull him back. So I think what will happen is, for the next 90 days, to try to influence the regulations, the rules that will be promulgated by Department of Ag, Commerce, Treasury, and so forth, I think that's where the last attempt to make an influence on the future of this administration will come. Once that's done, I think it's done. Unless, and I don't see it happen because I don't see the president signing it into law, unless Congress gets the will and the votes to remove the Cuban embargo. It's a piece of legislation. The president of the United States then has to decide if he's going to sign it or veto it. And every indication, obviously, that we've seen in the last 5 days, he would veto it.
Well, former State Senator Dan Rutherford, former state treasurer as well, you are now operating Global Relations Travel Club, and you are continuing to do trips to Cuba, too.
Yeah, I was just down there last week. We're going to take off for the summer of July and August. It's hot there, but we're going back in September, October, two trips in November.
So for you, this new approach by the Trump administration means just a little more paperwork?
Yeah, we're going to have to see some of the places we go to. The U.S. State Department is going to issue a list of some of the restaurants you can't go to because it's invested in by the Cuban military. And I'm like, okay. In fact, we've been doing that as much as possible, go to private enterprises every place we can, just because I happen to believe in that. But the other thing that it'll cause us to do is go back to the same extra paperwork that we were doing before President Obama announced his changes, which I came from government, so I understand how the paper pushers work.
Well, Dan Rutherford, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Colleen.
GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds speaking with State Treasurer Dan Rutherford about the impact of President Trump's Cuba policy. It's Sound Ideas on GLT and WGLT.org.
WGLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, building relationships while supporting and serving the community. Justin offers life insurance options designed to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's an edition of What's on Your Turntable. Find out what GLT's John Norton heard at Waiting Room Records. That's coming up during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Another week of special legislative sessions is ahead in Springfield, and the Illinois Public Radio Politics Roundtable is gauging if a state budget is close. Sean Crawford moderates the discussion among IPR government reporter Tony Arnold, Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, and IPR Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey. Mackey says there have been meetings between House Republican leader Jim Durkin and House Speaker Mike Madigan, but it's unclear whether more will come of that.
Sadly, at this point, a meeting between Republicans and Democrats, at least outside the Senate, is kind of news and some ray of hope here, because they, particularly the House Speaker and the governor, I guess, have had one face-to-face meeting this year, at least that's been reported publicly that I've seen. And so to have the House Speaker meet with Republican leader Jim Durkin is kind of a big deal, because there has been very little progress toward any sort of resolution, at least publicly, in the House. So, yeah, there's been meetings, but I mean, there certainly hasn't been any sort of unveiling of a true compromise legislation where both sides agree to it. The Republicans have put forth what they say is their attempt at a compromise. Well, they don't say that. That's me characterizing it. They just call it the compromise plan. But, you know, it's basically their attempt at saying, well, this is as far as we can go. We can negotiate on the margins. But as we heard Leader Durkin say at the top of the show, it's got to have these elements in it. You know, term limits for statewide elected officials. It's got to have changes to the workers' compensation system. It's got to have these things that the governor has really been asking for 2 years now. The speaker still says, well, my priority has always been balancing the budget through cuts and revenues. And he's been saying that for 2 years, and here we are. But at least they are meeting.
I think I'd add to that, there's already been some, I guess, some changes. And since the start of the special session on Wednesday of this week, you know, since from where it started to where it is now, because where this started, when the governor announced lawmakers need to come back for 10 days till the end of the month, the response to that from Senate President John Cullerton was, we don't need special sessions. We need Republicans to basically stage a coup against Governor Rauner and have Republicans get on board with this Senate budget plan, and which is really in competition with what the Republicans have introduced as their budget plan. So you have these two competing interests here. And since Cullerton basically called for this Republican coup, which obviously is not happened or going to happen, the fact that the speaker then has met with House Republican leader Jim Durkin is a very different stage, I'd say, than where this thing started with calling for the other side to go against their own leader, the guy that would need to sign the bills.
Charlie, usually when a budget is put together, at least in the past, it involved the top leaders and the governor getting together. They would work out the details, and then they'd take those back to their rank and file, and eventually there would be a vote up or down. And that makes me question, why have the entire legislature come back for all of these days of special session at a taxpayer cost when nothing has worked out?
Well, that's a pretty good question. It's one I asked myself. And basically, it's showbiz. It's the governor trying to look like he's doing something. And it's a waste of money. Now, maybe for somebody in his income bracket, spending $40,000, $50,000 a day is no big deal. But for most of us, it is. And as a matter of fact, I know some TV operations were taking cheap shots because in the Senate, not everybody showed up. And, oh, this is terrible. What would happen to me if I didn't show up for work? And I'm thinking to myself, God bless the people who didn't show up, because that's per diem and mileage that we're not having to pay. And you're right, Sean, the way it's always been, or at least during, I shouldn't say always, but during the years I was covering the legislature, and it was 20-some years, the norm was that we'd have this partisan bickering through like the first two-thirds of the session. And then the leaders and the governor would say, okay, now it's time to be grown-ups. We're going to put away all this childish nonsense. We get in a room. We hash out the details. What do you need? Here's what I need. How far can you go on this? I can go so far on this other thing. Take it back to the caucuses, see what they think, and they come to an agreement. And sometimes you did have special sessions, but it would not be called until there was something ready to vote on, simply because they didn't want to waste the money.
And I think that's the most stunning part to me, is it's one thing if you brought them all back and you're having all of these meetings, but it doesn't seem as though those meetings are taking place, so there's not a lot for these folks to do at this point. Is the governor hoping, as you might know, if the governor's just hoping that there will be some, I'll use the term coup again, but maybe on the Democratic side, the Democratic lawmakers will say, hey, House Speaker Michael Madigan, let's get something done?
I mean, I think that's certainly a hope, right? That's been the governor's hope all along, is that he could convince Democrats to turn against the speaker, their allies and unions. He's always had this idea that he might be able to turn Democrats. Well, I mean, he was very blunt about it back in 2012 before he was even running. He talked about using social justice spending, social service spending as a wedge to divide Democrats over their support for public employee unions. But more recently, he put when he came into office, he started a PAC, a political action committee, a fundraising committee that would, you know, support Democrats who supported his turnaround agenda, as he called it. And I think that's always been a hope. I mean, I guess looking at the special session, you know, looking at it in its most positive light, it is focusing public attention on the problems in Illinois government. And remarkably, after 2 years of budget impasse, I think that's still a problem. You still have polls that have said that a majority of Illinoisans think the impasse is not affecting them. I would argue, and other people would argue, that they just don't maybe realize how it's affecting them and affecting their communities, because it's a lot of the effects of it are invisible. You don't see the social service agencies, you know, that help the homeless teenagers who have to shut down programs, things like that. Looking at it in a more, you know, cynical way, you could say that the governor is trying to insulate himself from whatever happens if there is no budget. He's out there. He's now got these TV clips. You know, he delivered this video message that I guess a few TV stations in Illinois carried live on Tuesday night. He was in the old state capitol, and he, you know, he has repeatedly been using the word compromise. That's kind of been remarkable to watch around here during, you know, the Republicans call it their compromise budget. The governor used the word compromise again and again. Even the groups that are allied with Republicans, when they were testifying at the workers' compensation hearing, were using the word compromise. There's really a lot of coordination on that side of the aisle to use the word compromise because they want to project that they are the ones trying to, you know, be the ones who make a deal. And, you know, if there is no budget, which seems like, based on 2 years of past experience, certainly a possibility, a political possibility, then at least he can say, look, I'm the one out there. I was trying to do the compromise. He'll have these video clips, a TV anchor saying, governor gave a speech calling for compromise, and we don't have a budget. So that's sort of the more cynical way of looking at it.
Well, Tony, is you've reported on this Republican, what we call the compromise plan they put forward, what they're calling that. You pointed out some of the things that were in that, including, you know, a property tax freeze. That seems like you could get at least some Democrats to support that, to go along with the Republicans to pass that. What seems to be really the sticking point then in getting a budget deal if some of these things have bipartisan support?
The sticking point, the big one, is raising income taxes. That's what it's coming down to, and you're getting pressure. You know, each party's putting pressure on their own leaders, and so this is about at this point in time, I think that a lot of this is about rank and file members' relationships with their own party's leadership. Look at the Republicans, for instance. Governor Rauner, in his speech introducing the special sessions that Brian was talking about, the call for unity, he basically said, "I support this Republican plan that does call for an income tax hike. It also calls for tax hikes on tattoo parlors or streaming services like Netflix." And this is problematic for a lot of Republicans. They're getting pressure from some of their own supporters to what are you doing? Why are you supporting this? You've been you ran your campaign for Governor Rauner, on lowering the income tax rate, even lower than what it is now, and now you're calling for a tax hike? What's going on with that? So there's pressure on the Republicans to not go along with that plan, from the outside at least. And then on the Democratic side, You have representatives from Chicago that have been saying, yes, we need this higher income tax hike. We should all take this vote. But they don't have enough to carry it on their own. They would need Republican supports. There's not enough votes even to get a simple majority, even though Democrats are in the majority in the House. So there's this divide within the Democratic Party about taking this sensitive vote to raise taxes just because it's going to be such a polarizing issue for the next year and a half leading up to next year's campaigns. And on the Republican side, it's you campaigned on lowering taxes, and now you're saying that you're okay with raising them. Go ahead.
Sorry, I would just add two things to what you're saying. Not only did they campaign past tense on not raising taxes, they are actively campaigning now. I live in a district that is represented by a Democrat. I'm getting mailers at home attacking this Democrat for supporting Mike Madigan's tax increase budget. The governor has these TV ads out there attacking Speaker Madigan for wanting to raise your taxes with no reforms. And it's true, the Republicans, they introduced this compromise plan. They say they'll support a tax increase, but I think it's interesting and worth noting that their plan, it includes bills to deal with state spending. It spends at a level that assumes there would be a tax increase, but there's not actually a tax increase bill in their plan. So far, no Republican in the legislature that I'm aware of, at least as of this taping, has put their name on a bill as a sponsor of an amendment or the bill itself to actually raise taxes. And this, again, goes to the question of trust around here. I think Charlie has said before, everybody needs to hold hands and jump off the cliff together on something like this, a tax increase. And you have the Republicans sort of dipping their toe in the water, but from the Democratic perspective, not going as far as they might have. Senate Democrats especially say, look, we took the risk. We put our votes on a tax hike, on a balanced budget, using the governor's numbers that he introduced, and they want to see the Republicans go as far. But, as Tony said, it is significant. You can parse it and say, well, there was never a bill, but now the governor is at least on the record in this forum of supporting more revenue.
And I would just add, to Charlie's point earlier about how they're not actually doing much of anything right now. I mean, Cullerton said leading up to this that he would not give the Republican plan a hearing even until one of the Republicans put their name as the chief sponsor of a bill raising taxes. And until that happens, they're not going to get a hearing, which is why the Senate's been very quiet so far.
Charlie, when it comes to taxes, usually what we've seen in the past is there's a give and take. If you're going to vote for a tax, there's going to be something for it. Maybe it's projects. Maybe it's some other program that's being funded by it. Is there enough on the table right now for lawmakers to vote for taxes? Is that a big part of this problem, that there's not enough incentive?
Well, I haven't read all the bills, but my understanding is that one of the provisions, or some of the provisions in the so-called capital compromise that the Republicans put forward, where their left hand agreed with their right hand, includes money for what are called earmarks, public works projects in individual legislators' districts. And as I say, I have not read the bill. I will confess that up front. But typically what happens is those types of projects are an incentive for a lawmaker to vote for increased revenue, because the lawmaker can come back and say, yeah, you're going to have to pay a little more for, when you want to buy a six-pack of beer, but on the other hand, the high school gym is getting a new roof. And that road out in front that's got all those potholes? Those are going to be taken care of. So there are tangible, physical benefits that the constituent can see came from the increased revenue. The difficulty in this case is that a lot of the new money is going to have to go to pay off old bills. So it's going to be harder to say, here's this bright new shiny thing you got for paying more. It's like, well, we're going to catch up on all the bills that we should have paid years ago.
And, of course, that you could make an argument then that's the price of not doing anything for so long. So you've made your bed. You have to lie in it.
Yeah. You look at the pension systems, and they're, $130 billion unfunded liability for the five pension systems for which the state is responsible. those have been underfunded for more than 100 years. So it's not that it's all Mike Madigan's fault or Bruce Rauner's fault or Pat Quinn or anybody like that. This goes back involving lawmakers and governors of both parties for a century. And the reason is the temptation always was to spend on stuff that helps people right now rather than put aside money for a future that you know will come, but not until you're out of office.
Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield was part of the Illinois Politics Roundtable. Joining him were reporters Tony Arnold and Brian Mackey, along with moderator Sean Crawford. You're listening to Sound Ideas. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Inspiration can come from many places. For one Central Illinois author, it comes from those who are making a difference in our world. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of the GLT Datebook.
For Twin Cities author R.T. Wolf, creativity flourishes when she focuses on the good works of nonprofit organizations like Child Rescue. The organization that fights child trafficking figures in her latest romantic suspense novel, Savage Alliance. It was just a handful of years ago that Wolf actually started writing, and she says she doesn't have the typical writer origin story.
It was actually an accident.
How do you accidentally become a writer?
It was one of those middle-of-the-night things. Just middle of the night, started writing. I don't remember starting that first line or that first 100 lines or first few pages, but I came out of the end of a tunnel with a book. Never planned to have it published by any means, but fate had a different story, so here I am 10 books later, published in 2013. So yes, I still have a little bit of whiplash and getting used to this new world of publishing, but I'm very fortunate and blessed and grateful.
You write in the romantic suspense genre. What attracts you to that?
I guess it's mostly because it's what I enjoy reading. I need a little bit of action. Someone hooks up, someone dies, I always say.
You write the Nikki Savage book series, and your most recent is Savage Alliance. And this has some very serious subject matter going on with us. You actually worked with Child Rescue of North America for real authenticity in this book. So can you tell me about what inspired it?
In my first books, I started working with different organizations, as most authors do, regarding their authenticity and fact-finding and things as they're developing the outlines and as they write their manuscripts. I started working with East Coast Center for Conservation and Biology. I have a book, the main character is a conservation biologist.
The Black Creek series.
The Black Creek series, yes. Character who specializes in the banding and rehabilitation of bald eagles, and worked with the East Coast Center for Conservation Biology. They were beautiful and helped me with some facts and authenticity, and I got just very involved in promoting their cause and their organization, and they have a page on my website, and giving percentages of my books to their organization. And then I ended up doing this again with Master Gardeners, with Operation Migration, with Anna Maria Island Turtle Watch. And then when I started writing the series and this character, she just fell into, you know, characters do have their own minds.
We're talking about Nikki.
Yes.
Nikki is your lead character.
Yes, and please forgive me because authors speak about their characters like they're real people.
I completely understand that.
So
and
yes.
That's what makes them so enjoyable to readers, because they live for you. They live for the reader.
So she is a victim of trafficking. I started experimenting with that. That started coming to fruition. I started doing some research on different trafficking organizations and looked into a few and really got hooked into Child Rescue. They have an amazing story. So yes, been incorporating them quite specifically, and even the founder, Jess Larson, he is actually an actual character.
You turned a real person into a character.
I did. I even gave him his name.
How does he feel about that?
He's amazing and very helpful and wonderful. Now, the story is mostly about Nikki and her overcoming her past and this Duncan Reed, who also has his own past, and how they complement each other and combat as well. The trafficking is not heavy. It's not depressing. There's still some dry humor. There's good stories, and there are a lot of really, really good happy endings that come out of work with helping these children and women that have been trafficked.
So you were really dedicated to working with nonprofit organizations with your own creativity. You get to know them and what they're doing, and you absorb it and bring it into the imagination, the realm of romantic suspense.
Yes, and that has just become my drive and my love is working with that. I can't imagine ever writing another series that did not involve some kind of issue or organization, because this is where it's at. I live for this.
Tell me how readers are reacting to your books.
You know, I've had some great success with bringing these different causes to people who might not normally pick up that kind of information.
That's author R.T. Wolf. Her latest book is Savage Alliance. You can find it and her other novels at major booksellers like Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and at iTunes. I'm Laura Kennedy.
In addition to the Nikki Savage series, R.T. Wolf has also created the Black Creek novel series, plus the Island Escape series. It's Sound Ideas.
If you want to start something, start strong.
Call me Ishmael.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
Join in the fun at the first ever GLT Bocce at the Village, September 9th at Normandy Village.
In a hole in the ground lived a hobbit.
Once upon a time, there was a pair of pants.
Get your team together now for this friendly competition.
It was a dark and stormy night.
It's the first ever GLT Bocce at the Village. It'll be one for the books. More info at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. For a record store named after a Fugazi album, John Norton heard an album at Waiting Room Records that was a little out of left field. Norton talks with the owner, Jared Alcorn, for this edition of What's on Your Turntable.
Death is real. Someone's there and then they're not. And it's not for singing about. It's not for making into art.
Normally when I walk into Waiting Room Records in Uptown Normal, there's something loud on, there's something up-tempo poppy on. I don't walk in and go, where's the funeral? This was Mount Erie?
Mount Erie.
Okay, why have you been listening to this so much lately?
Oh, man. I'm going to be honest, like, the first time I put it on, I'd heard great things about it. I put on track one. I listened to it. It's 2 minutes and 28 seconds, and I immediately turned it off. I was just not in the mindset to listen to it at that point. I mean, I guess we should say at the beginning of this interview, this is a trigger for some people if they've recently lost somebody. The first time I actually put the album on, I put it on in the store, and it was kind of a dead day. It was rainy and dreary, and I was like, all right, I'm gonna put it on. After listening to it, I mean, I lost it. I started crying in the shop because these lyrics hit me so hard. I was trying to pull it together because I didn't want somebody to come in, and I'm like sobbing at the counter, like, ah! But it just, at that moment, it hit real hard for me. I don't know. So it's not something that I'm going to say I'm going to put on every single day. And I do recommend that you be in the mindset and be ready to go on this journey with him.
What's the track we're listening to right now?
The song is called Real Death.
A week after you died, a package with your name on it came, and inside was a gift for our daughter. You had ordered in secret and collapsed there on the front steps. I wailed.
Okay, so I think I know where we're going. The song is called A Real Death.
Yeah.
Well, give us a little bit of background about the group.
So it's essentially Phil Elverum. He started out under the name Microphones back in 1999. And then he put out in 2003, put out a concept record called Mount Erie. And since then, he retired the microphone's name and has just continued on as Mount Erie. This is his eighth album as that name.
Okay.
It's dumb, and I don't want to learn anything from this. I love you.
This record is entirely about the passing of his wife, Genevieve Castre. She was a musician, a writer, a visual artist, and she passed away of stage 4 pancreatic cancer in July of 2016.
Oh, real recently.
He put this record out within 6 months of her passing away.
Well, why don't we go through some of the tracks and maybe you can explain what's going on here.
This whole album is him kind of singing to her and about her, about what he's going through and about their life. He's always been really good about singing about, like, spirituality and mortality, but on this record, it's moving past that, and he's just kind of swallowing us in his entire loss.
Sounds like something almost that you wouldn't have thought would see the light of day. It's more, I'll record this at home, I'm grieving, maybe I'm in a closet somewhere, no one's ever going to hear this yet. Here we are listening.
There are certain parts of the album where I don't know what stage of grieving he's at.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this album to me kind of sounds like it's almost like a reflex that it just happened because he's dealing with this. He did record the entire thing with her instruments and in her studio. Kind of hurts to listen to sometimes. It's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful, but it's heavy.
Cold because I won't close the window. Just in case something still needs to leave, I stand in the yard and look up.
A Crow Looked at Me, Mount Erie, is what we're listening to. This is What's on Your Turntable. Jared Elkhorn at Waiting Room Records is taking us through this album. You want to take us through some specific tracks?
Yeah, so this is Seaweed, which is the second track. And, he tells us right off the bat, she's been dead 11 days.
You have been dead 11 days.
So that hurts. And then he's kind of referencing that he's looking for her in nature, and that means kind of like, is that a flower growing in the woods, or is that her? He talks about at the end of the song how he takes a chair from their home and puts it in the woods and pours her ashes on it so she can look at the sunset. But even then, he tells us that he doesn't see her as the ashes, he sees her as the sunset.
I brought a chair from home, I'm leaving it on the hill, facing west and north, and I poured out your ashes on it.
Let me take you to another track. This is Ravens, the very next track, track 3. I think the guitar line in this song is beautiful. It sounds like a lullaby almost, but it's very, very sad. In this song, he explains that she's been passed for 1 month and 3 days. The song's pretty heavy, and where he gets very descriptive in watching her body get weaker, and how he tells us how he kind of watched her die in this room. There's a certain line that really hit me where he says that she has cancer and that she was killed. Usually when you hear someone say something about cancer, it's usually they died or they passed from. No one actually says they've been killed by cancer. And just having that be the descriptive word really hits home of how, like, it was way harsher than in something that he has to deal with, the fact that someone has been killed by this terrible disease.
Black feathers tinted in the sunset. I knew these birds were omens, but of what I wasn't sure.
Waiting Room Records is where we're at, listening to the new album, A Crow Looked at Me, by Mount Erie. This is GLT's Sound Ideas. Do you got one more song you want to talk about?
Yeah, this is Swims. This is, I hate to say, my favorite song on the album, but...
All right, hold that thought. Let's give it a quick listen here.
Sure. This song's devastating. There is a certain point of where he talks about how they walk to counseling. And each week it gets harder and harder to get there because she's becoming slower and slower.
I can't get the image out of my head.
It's just kind of him talking with this counselor about how this grieving process is going to work. And then you get hit with something that we find out is not actually a story. It's his life. 2 months after his wife passes, his counselor passes.
Oh, jeez.
And he walks past her office and he sees that the lights are off, and even says the line, like, almost as if her job is done. And then later in the song, it's his daughter asking if Mama swims. And there's a pause in the lyrics as if he's trying to figure out how to answer that question. And then he says, yes, she does swim, and that's probably all she does now.
Your last gasping breaths. I see it again and again. As the breeze blew in.
It's a tough listen, unfortunately, for a lot of people. They can relate, too. It's
yes.
Mount Erie, A Crow Looked at Me, Waiting Room Records in Uptown Normal. Jared Elkhorn, thank you for playing this album for us. And let's put on something peppier after this.
Will do.
GLT's John Norton talking with Waiting Room Records' Jared Elkhorn about the new album from the group Mount Erie. What's playing on your turntable? Norton occasionally drops by area record stores to hear what's on their turntables. We want to know what you're listening to. Drop us a line at WGLT.org or at facebook.com/WGLTFM.
As we wove through the cedar grove, I walked in, you bobbed and dove.
Our website is where you can download the Sound Ideas podcast or find the individual interviews today from Colleen Reynolds, Laura Kennedy, and John Norton. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Share your thoughts at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet, use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLTFM.
You said, crow, and I asked, are you dreaming about a crow? And there she was.
This is WGLT Normal.